Neil Plaxey, the last time you were on was 2.5 years ago. And if you can believe it, it was that long. The title of that episode is Neil Plaxey, Let's Talk About Sex. And our conversation focused primarily on how much sex is too much sex in a mystery novel. So my question is, over those 2.5 years, have you found that answer yet?
I think that a lot more women are writing mystery in the gay mystery genre, and women in general put a lot of sex into their MM stories. But I think I found that more and more gay men who are writing mysteries are closing the door on the sex. It's not as important anymore.
You know what? If you want a mystery, read a mystery. If you want erotica, read erotica. They're two different things, in my opinion, and I think they're both awesome. I just don't necessarily want them together.
When I started writing the Mahu series, it was a lot about the characters coming out and getting into relationships and learning about sex. And so the sex was important to the story. Now that I'm on book 13 and he's settled into a long-term relationship, the things like family are much more important than the sex between them.
That's a very good point. As your characters change, that can change. I never thought sex was that big a deal, but Michael Navas said something to me that really stuck with me. He said, sex can be important because how a person has sex can tell you a lot about the individual.
I think that's true. And it also has to do with things like the development of a relationship and the development of trust between the two parties, that they might start out in less penetrative modes, let's just say, and move up towards that as they begin to trust each other. And the whole use of condoms in a sex scene, if two parties have been together for a long time and have been monogamous, they don't need to bother with it. But if it is a newer relationship or a casual encounter, then I think as authors, we have the responsibility to model that kind of same sex or safe sex.
Well, let me tell you what I do. This has been an argument on Facebook quite a bit, the whole condom issue. And my response to that is always, I don't mention condoms when my characters have sex. I don't mention that they're wearing them. I don't mention that they're not wearing them. I let the reader decide what works best in their head.
And I think that's a choice that the author gets to make.
Exactly.
And it has to do also with, again, who the characters are and what the level of their relationship is.
Exactly. So anyway, the whole sex thing was our last conversation. Let's talk about other stuff right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. This is Brad, and my guest that I was speaking with is the well-respected and well-loved author Neil Plaxey. It's a pleasure to have you back, Neil.
Thanks, Brad. It's great to be back.
I don't know why we waited 2.5 years, but at least you're here.
Oh, I know why we waited, because there are so many other awesome queer writers of crime, and you've been really great about providing a platform to introduce people to those authors.
Well, thank you. And, you know, people talk in the podcasting circles, they're like, wow, you really have a niche audience. And I'm like, I do. I definitely have a niche audience, but I've had, right now we're going on, I think around 100, close to 150 episodes. And I said, I haven't even scratched the surface. So it's not nearly as niche as you may think it is.
Well, and, you know, when I first started writing in this genre, I did a lot of reading myself and I had a whole gay mystery section on my website of what I was reading and my thoughts about those authors. And gradually the growth in the genre just overwhelmed me and I had to take it off because I just wasn't keeping up.
Well, and I want to talk about that, but first I want to introduce you a little bit more. For folks that don't know, Neil is a 4-time nominee for the Lambda Literary Awards. He is best known, I believe, for his Mahu investigative series. Did I say that correctly?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. I'm terrible. My sister lives in Hawaii, and I'm terrible with Hawaiian words. She makes fun of me. And he's also well known for his Golden Retriever mysteries. And going back to what you said about authors in the past, you said the earliest novels that you read with gay protagonists were by Michael Nava, Mark Zubrow, and Joseph Hansen, and that they inspired you. And now Hansen's first novel was in 1970. Michael Nava's was in 1986. And then Mark Zubrow was in 1989. When you first published, it was over 15 years later. Do you believe they cleared some of the obstacles for you? And what do you think that you were able to do that you couldn't have done before?
Well, for me, a lot of my debut, let's say, was part of my own coming out process, that it was a long time coming. And so it was not until I kind of came out that I found my voice and found my subject matter. And at the time that I started writing Mahu, I didn't realize there was a genre of gay mysteries. And I was at the Key West Literary Seminar, which that year was Literature in the Age of AIDS. And I met a gay man who said, "Oh, you're writing a gay mystery. Have you read Joseph Hansen and Michael Nava?" And like, "No, I didn't even realize this genre existed." And so through him, I discovered those authors and started to read them. And, you know, we didn't have the internet back then. And so the way that you would only discover these kind of books was going to a bookstore and asking. And unless you had a gay bookstore in your area, you couldn't really go into Barnes & Noble. At least I wasn't comfortable for a long time going into Barnes & Noble and saying, "Hey, do you have any gay books here?" I wasn't even that comfortable asking, "Where's the gay book section?" I would just kind of go wander around the store myself and hope that I found something. And often it was a mixture of nonfiction and fiction and gay and lesbian. And it was, just one shelf. And you really had to dig through to find what you were looking for.
Yeah. And I think it was on one episode, and I think it was when I was talking to the guys over at Rote Podcast, that they pointed out that gay section was always right next to the self-help section. And I thought about it, and I said, they're right, it was.
Well, and it was also next to, like, the African-American section. It was, this is where we're going to put all the niche audience stuff.
Exactly, yes. What obstacles do you think you faced during that earlier time, other than your own personal thought process?
I was fortunate to get an agent for Mahu, and she sent the book out to perhaps five publishers. And then she came back and said, "Nope, they all turned it down. And, there's nobody else that I can send it to. So go on and write the next book." And I didn't know what else to say other than, okay. And then I actually was at the Miami Book Fair, and Jay Quinn, who's a wonderful writer, was there promoting a book on gay cowboys, I think, or no, gay men from the South. And I said, I don't really have that much interest in this, but I'm going to go to hear him just because he's a queer author who's coming to town. And I did. And I had the opportunity to ask at the end of his presentation, to ask a question. And I said, "Hey, my agent says that the gay mystery genre is dying. Do you agree?" And he said, "No, actually, I'm freelance editing for a press called Haworth Press. And we have an imprint called Harrington Park Press. And I've just hired a sub-editor to work on gay genre fiction, particularly horror, mystery, romance, etc." And I said, "Can I have your card?" And that editor that he hired was Greg Herron.
Oh.
And Haworth had already turned down Mahu the first time because at that time they weren't doing genre fiction. But I was able to send it to Greg. He loved it. I'm eternally grateful to him for recognizing the promise in that book and publishing it. So, it was just a combination of luck and perseverance that eventually got me published. And then shortly after that, the people who owned the guy who owned Haworth Press sold it to someone else. It was primarily an academic publisher, and he sold it to another academic publisher who discontinued all the LGBT titles. And I was left adrift. And again, fortunate coincidence, a friend of mine who wrote pet-related stuff was editing for an imprint of some major press on their pet books. And her boss took over at Allison. And my friend Sharon said, hey, my friend has taken over at this gay press. We should do something together. And so that was the genesis for Pause and Reflect, Gay Men and Their Dogs. We combined her interest in dogs, my interest in gay men and their relationships. And then as a result, Allison picked up the next couple books in the Mahu series until they, you know, were bought out and then folded out of existence. So, you know, there's a lot of luck and perseverance, I think, involved in any publishing effort.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, publishers, as you know, have a stack on their desk, and their job is really to discard books. So any little thing they can find, goodbye, because there's no way they can read them all.
Right.
So yeah, a lot of it, you just hopefully grasp their eye and they'll read it and there you go. And you may have heard me say it sounds like our
personal journeys.
Our journey, thank you. Journey was the word I was looking for. It was very similar. I thought the only kind of gay novel was romance. That's all I thought there was. So I said, okay, if I'm going to write a gay novel, I'll have to write a romance. And what I'll do is I'll put a mystery in it. And, you know, romances with mystery, it's an old trope and it's a fine trope and they're fun to watch. But romance just wasn't my thing. And I even took a class with Karina Press, which not many people have heard of, but it's actually Harlequin Romance's gay romance division. They kind of keep it secret that they're the same company, but they are. And I was miserable. I just struggled and struggled and struggled. And then I fell into two books. One by Mark McNeice, and the other was by Scott Sherman, who unfortunately seems to have vanished, but I'm still looking for him. And they opened this whole world of LGBTQ mystery for me, and it's been wonderful ever since.
Scott's a great guy. I know him, and I've hung out with him quite a bit in the past. He has a family, and I think probably right now he's focused on his family, but hopefully he will come back.
I know when he stopped writing, he did a podcast on gay parenting, but I didn't know what he did after that. So before I forget, there is something really important that we need to get out, and that is when this episode airs, it will be 2 days before your 65th birthday. And happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you very much.
You have something exciting planned for your readers that they can do after this show, and I want you to share what that is.
Sure. It's my 65th birthday, but the readers get the gifts. And so I have put together a list of 65. They're all dog-related gifts because this is primarily my, you know, my dog mystery audience. But all somebody has to do is come to my website, mahubooks.com, mahubooks.com. And there's a link on the front page where you can get a free short story and then enter the contest to win any one of 65 dog-related prizes, which was a lot of fun for me to go through and surf through Amazon looking for dog stuff. And my dogs are making out like bandits because I'm like, oh, that's great. Oh, we could use that. Oh, I'm going to buy one of those.
Well, 65 gifts is pretty awesome. That's quite a task to put together.
Well, actually, there's 5 grand prize gifts, one for each day. And then there's 12 subsidiary gifts, which are the same every day.
It's still generous.
It is. I want people to sign up for my newsletter is really the bottom line here. And so I said, I could throw myself a party or I could spend the money on building my readership and giving back to the readers who have supported me.
Well, fun, wonderful. And I will have a link to that. And the listener can join me in the end of the sentence in the show notes.
Thank you.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows. But if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
Normally, I begin with chit-chat, but I want to get right to your novel. And that is because you have done something interesting with your two literary worlds. And you just mentioned your dog audience. And you also have the Mahu series, which I guess you would call your gay mystery audience. I don't know what you call it, but that's what I would call it. But you're doing something here. You're shaking things up a bit. What is that?
I've always had gay supporting characters in the Golden Retriever mysteries. And kind of occasional plot-related subplots, a romance, a coming out, etc. And my Golden Retriever mysteries are really much more successful because they reach a more mainstream audience than either the Mahu Investigations or my Have Body, Will Guard, Bodyguard adventure romance series. And so what I wanted to try and do was bring those two audiences together. And I wrote a book years ago, which sadly I had to take out of print because the whole premise is flawed. And that book was called The Buchanan Letters. And the idea behind it was that a gay history professor at a small college in Pennsylvania discovered a cache of letters that indicated that President James Buchanan had had a same-sex relationship. And I wrote the book, published it, got a lot of fans for it. And then a real historian discovered a real relationship that Buchanan had with a senator from Alabama. And that just kind of destroyed completely the premise of the Buchanan letters. But the characters really stayed with me. The history professor, and then the man who becomes his lover, who is a globe-trotting journalist who takes advantage of him to restart his own career. But, you know, there was a real connection between them. And so I kept thinking about those two characters and what might have happened to them afterwards. And I realized that the photojournalist, or the journalist, was lying about everything down to his name. And then I thought, what if he died and the history professor discovered that everything Pascal said was a lie? If he said, my name is Pascal Montrouge, and that was a lie. And he said, I love you, Jeff. Was that a lie too? And so I wrote this exploration of Jeff discovering why his lover had fabricated his entire life. And that turned into a murder mystery. And I set it in the same general area, in the same world as the Golden Retriever mysteries. My canine sleuth Rochester makes a cameo appearance in Being John Church, this new book, to help discover a clue. So I'm trying to tie the two series together. And we'll see what happens.
Well, when this episode airs, it will be 1 week before Being John Church releases. And so the book is on pre-order, so go ahead and get it now. I can tell you, you won't regret it. You won't regret it. It's a lot of fun. It's a fun read. I was going to ask you to tell a little about a story, and you've done a very good job. Can you tell us a little bit more without giving too much away?
Sure. Jeff and Pascal are living together, but Pascal is working on a big project, and he needs some time and space. And anybody who's a writer, certainly, or knows a writer, can understand that. So Pascal gets a sublet in Greenwich Village, where he goes to work on his book. At the very beginning of the book, so it's not a giveaway, he's running across the street in Greenwich Village and gets hit by a truck. And that kicks off this discovery that Jeff makes. He and his friend organize a funeral for Pascal. And at the funeral, this very ordinary couple comes up to him and says, thank you so much for organizing this for our son, John. And he's like, excuse me, do you have the right funeral? I'm like, yeah, no, that was our son. And that revelation kicks off his exploration of who was this guy. And that was really, it was a lot of fun for me to do. And it was just fascinating to say, what would make someone, essentially Pascal is 16 when he leaves his parents, cuts himself off from his past and completely reinvents himself. What would cause someone to do that? And that was really an interesting thing to figure out.
Well, I got to tell you, at that moment, I felt in my gut what Jeff must have felt like, at least if I had found that out, that my partner's entire life was a lie. You know, it's hard to say how you would feel, but what I felt was not good.
Yeah.
Not good at all.
And it's also, if you are a detective sort by nature, it's something that nags at you. What was that? What happened? What did I miss? How can I find out the story behind this? So that was just a really interesting thing to explore and to come up with the details and the story behind it. And I think there's a very strong reason why this 16-year-old completely cut himself off from his past. And that's something that readers will discover as they go along. And I think it's believable.
I want to tell you, for some strange reason, when I started reading your book, I was very confused. And it's not your fault. You mentioned Columbus Circle. And I don't know why. You said Columbus Circle, and my head went to DuPont Circle. So I'm thinking we're in Washington, D.C. And as I'm reading, I'm like, this isn't making any sense. And then finally it dawned on me, we were in New York. And like I said, it's you. I mean, it wasn't you, it was me. But boy, that threw me off for a little while.
I heard John Irving speak a long time ago. And if you ever read The World According to Garp.
Love it.
That book is very clearly set in Boston. But he never says that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in this speech he was making that when you use a noun, like a proper noun, or use a place like that, you lose your reader for a moment because the reader has their own association with that place. And so that's why he tries to never spell out a specific location. Let people get it from the details. So obviously, that was the case here. I used a particular place. My reader went off in his own mind to make those connections, and I lost you for a minute, hopefully. Or I'm glad to say, you know, it sounds like you came back.
Oh, I came back, and it all made sense. It all tied together. Yeah, it was just, it wasn't for very long, but I was like, this is odd. So, no, you only lost me for a few seconds. Don't worry about that at all.
But John Irving was right.
Yes, he was. And it's kind of the opposite of what Sue Grafton did. I can't remember the name of Kinsey Millhone's town.
Santa Teresa.
Okay. And it was Santa Barbara. It was right. Clearly, anybody that's ever been to Santa Barbara, she describes it in perfect detail. And the whole time I'm reading her series, I'm like, why the hell didn't she just say this is Santa Barbara? And actually, the whole time I'm reading it, it threw me off, actually, because that's all I kept thinking.
Well, you know, I think...
Why isn't she just say this is Santa Barbara?
What I've heard from other authors is, and I've seen myself, is that if someone really knows Santa Barbara and you have your character, for whatever reason, travel the wrong way on a one-way street or drive somewhere that doesn't go there, the reader will get annoyed. I grew up in the Trenton, New Jersey environs. Trenton is my hometown, and Janet Ivanovich set her Stephanie Plum series in Trenton, and she uses actual street names, which don't go the places she says.
Yeah.
And it really irritates me. And again, you know, I heard her speak at one point, and she said she didn't really care. She was using those names for general sense of place and figured that most of her readers wouldn't know and wouldn't care. And in my case, the Stewart's Crossing is the name of the fictional town in my Golden Retriever series. And it's basically my hometown, which is called Yardley, Pennsylvania. But I wanted to create other places and other things in the town that weren't in the actual place. So I tell readers periodically that it is located a few miles north of Yardley. So because it's that same kind of small town, river town with colonial heritage, all the features matter. They come together. When I'm writing the Mahu series, which is set very much in Honolulu, I really have to pay attention to roads and place names. And I spend a lot of time on YouTube and on the internet looking for pictures of places to make sure that I'm getting all those details correct. So it's a balancing act. Do you choose a real place to write about? In which case, I think you have to be faithful to the place. Mm-hmm. I heard you talk about the Hollywood sign and how much research you had to do in terms of where you could, how you could use the Hollywood sign in your book. I think that's, you know, it's a balancing act there. Do you choose a fictional place or a real place? But if you use a real place, you have to be very careful of the details.
Yeah, and I'm going to give a little secret here that I don't think I've told anybody. Because of what I learned about the Hollywood sign, I couldn't do my story exactly the way I want it to be, basically where the body was left. There are many trails around the Hollywood sign. The trail where the body was found doesn't exist. But anyway, that's just between you and I. That's our little secret.
Okay.
and you know what? What you said about Janet Ivanovich saying she doesn't care, that doesn't surprise me about her. And that's the last thing I'm going to say about her anyway. You remember the Vegas TV series back in the 70s that starred Robert Urich, I think?
Uh-huh.
Used to enjoy that show in the 70s. And then I moved to Vegas and lived there for about 3 horrible years. And I watched an episode of the old Vegas TV series, and actually several episodes. And, you know, they always show them driving around the city, and you can see the hotel signs in the windshield. And the whole time I'm like, to where he is, to where he's going, he would never pass that.
Yep.
And he was always driving. Basically, for him to go to wherever he was going in all kinds of crazy circles because it looked good in that windshield.
Yep. So,
but most people wouldn't know that, but boy, it drove me crazy. I thought, he must be drunk. Now, there's something in the book that kind of surprised me because you're in Florida and something came up that I thought was actually a California thing. And it's right at the beginning. Jeff and his friend Zenobia discover the victim had a dog named Rex. It says Jeff loved dogs, always had, but he drew the line at spoiled pooches who rode around in baby carriages. I will tell you, that is all over Los Angeles, and it drives me insane. Is that going on a lot in Florida, too?
It's in my neighborhood as well. I live in a gated community in Hollywood, Florida, so we're halfway between Fort Lauderdale and Miami, mm-hmm. and there are dogs in baby carriages all the time. And I think it's crazy, but I guess sometimes, you know, people want to go out for a walk. They want to get the dog out, but little dogs just can't walk as much, can't walk as far perhaps, or their paws hurt on the hot pavement, or they're just spoiled. My dogs are so big. I have a saying that sometimes I'm the dog and sometimes I'm the sled. Sometimes I'm pulling them along and sometimes they're pulling me. So I could never fit either of them into a baby carriage.
I will admit it's my own fault here. A dog is perfectly fine in a baby carriage, I'm sure. If that's the way somebody wants to treat their dog, that's fine. I really shouldn't give a shit. It is on me that it drives me insane, but it does.
I'm just surprised when I'm walking my dogs and we pass someone pushing a baby carriage and suddenly barking comes out of the carriage. And I'm like, what kind of a baby is in there?
That's the ugliest baby I've ever seen. Going back to the beginning of your book, I love humor in crime novels, and I love it in the most darkest suspense novels, and I love it even the most fast-paced action novels. I love when there's humor in there. And you had something early on in the book that made me not only laugh out loud, it made me laugh out loud hard. And I'm going to read it right here. Early in the book it said, "It seemed like the ultimate insult for a gay man to get killed by a tampon truck. Pascal swore he'd never seen a vagina up close, no less penetrated one." It took me a while to get back in the story because you had me laugh, and I loved that.
It did, you know, it did seem like if I wanted something absurd for this death, because death is a horrible thing, and especially when it's someone you love who dies. And so, you know, the ability to laugh about it lessens the pain, I think.
Well, you know, there's a lot of laughter in funerals if you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
I know the night my mom died, my brother and I went to Krispy Kreme. This is in North Carolina, back when Krispy Kremes were across the nation. And we laughed and laughed. There was all kinds of humor. Now, when we got back and she died soon after, the laughter stopped, but it started back up again. And one of the best scenes in probably movie history is Steel Magnolias in the cemetery, where Sally Field is doing this beautiful scene of her distraught over her daughter dying. And there's Olympia Dukakis says, "Slap Weeza." And it's hysterical. And it's so perfect. And that really is the way I think funerals happen. And people need that energy to release it. It's a great thing.
When I was a kid, I had a lot of great aunts and great uncles. And my great aunt Sarah was a big drama queen in the end. And so she had this habit of throwing herself on coffins. "Oh, my daughter. Oh, my sister. Oh, my brother," et cetera, et cetera. And so as we were teenagers, my cousins and I were designated to watch Aunt Sarah and grab her before she got up and made a scene. And, you know, we thought that was great fun. And it certainly leavened the atmosphere.
Well, yeah.
My best friend in college sadly passed away in her 30s. Her father died when she was maybe 12, and her mother had a nervous breakdown. And so she really had to raise her siblings. At her funeral, her sisters just were so distraught and tried to throw themselves onto the grave. And I thought, ugh, Iris would be so appalled at this behavior. And so, you know, it was something that I laughed at even as I was crying over my best friend's passing.
Exactly. And I'm going to date myself here, but probably the Mary Tyler Moore episode that people remember most is Chuckles Bites the Dust.
Yep.
When Chuckles the Clown dies, and it's an hysterical episode where they laugh through the whole funeral, embarrassed.
A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer down your pants.
You remember it well. That was a great series. This book takes place in New York, and you just said you're from New Jersey, so I get the New York connection that you have. What took you to Florida? I know that you're a professor there at Broward College.
So I went to college in Philadelphia. I went to graduate school in New York, and eventually I got a job with the Rouse Company, which built festival marketplaces, shopping centers, and I worked on South Street Seaport in Manhattan. And when that project finished, the next project that Rouse was going to work on was a place called Bayside in Miami. And I had been in New York for 5 years by then, and I was ready to leave. This was the 80s, and the streets were full of graffiti. The subways were full of urine. You know, there were homeless people on the streets. And I was like, you know, I came to New York based on that New York, New York song, "If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere." And really, I said, I knew at some point I wanted to have the time and space to take some time off and write. And I couldn't see that I could do that living in Manhattan. It was just so expensive, even back in the 80s, that if I stayed there, I never would be able to afford, you know, to take 6 months off and write. So I was offered the chance to move to Miami, and I said, yeah, I think I could do that. At least it'd be a less expensive place. And I got off the plane in September of 1986, and there were palm trees, and it was warm, and I said, I can stay here. And I have been here ever since, and just fell in love with the place.
And so you do love Florida.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm spoiled now. I could never live anywhere cold again.
Yeah, it's really, once you get used to that, it is really hard. I grew up as a little kid in Michigan. I moved to North Carolina, where it gets colder than people. It's not as cold as Michigan. It gets colder than people realize. But having lived in Phoenix and then Nevada and now in Southern California, I can't imagine going back to living in a cold environment. It's just, no way.
And plus, the other things that I love about Florida is the multicultural nature. In my neighborhood alone, I can hear Russian and Spanish and Portuguese and French Canadian and such a, you know, it's such a varied community. And teaching at a community college for 20 years, I had such a wide range of students that it was just constantly fascinating to explore different neighborhoods and learn about different foods and hear different accents.
I don't want to offend you or anybody else. I've been to Florida many times and I'm not a fan, but I've only spent small times there. The only time I really spent much time was in South Beach, and I actually loved South Beach. I was there for a conference, and every night we went to South Beach and had fun. Even though the bodies there were unreal, like they're sculpted out of wax, and I didn't feel like I fit in at all, I still had a gay old time. I need to learn the rest of Florida, I guess.
Well, and that's something that I have tried to do. In one of the series that we haven't talked about yet is my Angus Green FBI investigations. And Angus is a young, cute, redheaded FBI agent in his first big assignment in Miami. And he lives in Wilton Manors, which is a gay suburb of Fort Lauderdale, government, you know, entirely gay, city council, mayor, etc., primarily a home to older gay men. The typical narrative there is men who married women, had families, came out late in life, moved to Wilton Manors and met a man and now, you know, settled down together. So just a very different narrative from South Beach. It was a place that I hadn't really seen in fiction. But since then, Angus has gotten around to South Beach and to the Everglades and to the fancy suburbs. So it's been real fun for me to explore all those areas of my hometown.
Well, I'd never heard of this area that you mentioned, so that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Wilton Manors is a place that attracts two very different audiences. There are the cute young gay boys who are running away from other places and becoming bartenders and dancers. And then these much older men who are out there watching and tipping them. And not much really in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just a fascinating area.
It's not so much true anymore, but when I first moved to Los Angeles, you basically, when you were single, you lived in West Hollywood. And then once you got settled down, you and your partner moved to the Valley.
Uh-huh. And is Silver Lake in the Valley?
No, Silver Lake.
Because Silver Lake, I've heard, is a neighborhood for older men.
It definitely was. It was basically the older men, the bears, the not traditional twink-looking West Hollywood guys would live. And I'm stereotyping. There were gray areas everywhere.
Oh, sure.
But that is what Silver Lake was. West Hollywood and Silver Lake are not as gay as they used to be. Like most gay communities, they're kind of going away.
Well, I'll tell you, South Beach is not as gay as it used to be, although it still is plenty gay at times. Wilton Manors is still pretty gay. You know, because it was a poor neighborhood and the gay men moved in and gentrified it. And now you can't afford to go live there unless you are somebody who's trading up from a house somewhere else.
Well, that happens in a lot of places. And I will say that as long as South Beach keeps those pastel colors, it will always be gay.
Yep. I agree.
Now, the subtitle of the book is This is a Bucks County Mystery, which tells me this is the first in a series.
I do hope it will be. I have written other books that I hoped would be the first in a series that did not do well with an audience. And so I moved on to something else. But I already have the it's not a spoiler. By the end of the book, Jeff goes to work for some true crime podcasters, helping them with research. Because essentially that's what a history professor does, is research. And so I have an idea of what the next case is that I would like to put him onto. And it is, when I was a high school senior, I came from a class of 1,200 students, but there seemed like an awful lot of deaths in my class. And one in particular is particularly haunting. A classmate of mine who went to the mall, our local mall, bought some expensive photographic equipment, and then was killed in the parking lot on the way back to her car. None of the expensive stuff was stolen. Her wallet wasn't taken. She was a perfectly pleasant young woman, so it wasn't like she was discovered to be involved in anything criminal. And even 25 years later, the police, the newspaper did a follow-up. Crime was still unsolved, and the police detective was still pursuing cold case leads. And so I'd like to go back and revisit that and have Jeff perhaps discover that there was something more going on that he didn't realize, and perhaps some of those deaths in his high school might have all been related. So we'll see.
Well, after that book comes out, when you get that difficult question from interviewers, where do your ideas come from? You have the answer to that one.
Yep, exactly.
It's not always that easy to do.
Yep.
Now, you teach at Broward College.
I have been teaching. I am on summer vacation and not going back when school starts in a week.
Okay, well, I can tell you then there's going to be a lot of disappointed people, because I had a little fun whenever I have a professor on the show. I like to go to this website that you may know called ratemyprofessors.com.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
You're familiar with it. For those that don't know, it's basically what it says. It allows students to go on and rate their professors. And I've had fun because there's people I didn't like, and I looked them up and saw they had really low ratings. You had 107 ratings. Out of those, 91% said that you were great or awesome.
Oh.
And the number of awesomes far outweighed the number of greats.
Well, that's sweet.
You're breaking some hearts.
You know, my attitude towards teaching has been that I want students to be able to get the grade they want. Mm-hmm. And so even if you're not the greatest writer in my class, and maybe you're getting C's on your papers, I give them lots of opportunities to do discussion posts and extra credit and quizzes and so on. And so I get students who are very motivated because they recognize, okay, I really want an A in this class, but maybe I'm not the best writer. I want to take the class with a professor who will let me do this extra work and get a good grade. And so I think that philosophy is why I've gotten a lot of students. And I was asked how I get students to sign up for my literature course when other professors have trouble getting students to sign up for a lit class. And my sad answer is, well, because I have really good ratings on ratemyprofessor.com.
But yeah, the reasons they give are good, though. The primary reasons they gave are that you give good feedback, you have clear grading criteria, and you are respected and caring.
Oh.
That's pretty cool.
That's sweet. Honestly, our population are people who have a lot of trouble in their lives. They are poor. They are people, they're immigrants. They're people who haven't had good educations. They have to take care of their family obligations. They might have to take care of a sick family member. They don't have reliable transportation. And so I think that if you can meet them where they are and accept their situations, they are very grateful.
Well, let me go to the other side.
So, but now I want to hear what the bad ones say.
Yes. You know what? I got to go to the other side of the coin because it made me laugh. You only had one person give you one star. And they gave two reasons. The first one is, do you want to hear what they are?
I bet you. Is this the person who said, I didn't get a good grade because I couldn't spell his name?
No, I didn't see that one.
Oh, okay.
That may have been a two star. I don't know. I only looked at the one star. He said, you gave them too much to read, which I must say, how dare you, Mr. English professor? And the second one is that you're a tough grader. And I want to tell you, based on how that comment was written, you weren't tough enough on this individual.
Yeah, one of my favorite comments was, I always make a point of saying, if you can't spell my name, don't put it on your paper. It's part of respect, mm-hmm. And it's also part of paying attention. If you can't spell, if you don't remember how to spell my name, just don't put it on there. And I had one student who regularly misspelled my name, and every time, and this was a class where there are a lot of small assignments. So we're talking 5-6 times she's misspelled my name. And every time I would say, don't put my name on the paper if you can't spell it. And she ended up with a bad grade in the class. because she couldn't write and she couldn't pay attention to instructions and she couldn't learn. And that was her comment, that that's why she got a bad grade, because she couldn't spell my name. I'm like, well, I guess you didn't learn anything from this class.
Well, not only is it disrespectful, how could you not write your teacher's name the first day?
Well, and also we have an online learning management system. So my name is all over the place there.
Yeah.
And so all you have to do is look at the screen if you're worried about how to spell it. So, but it's been a fun ride. Let's put it that way.
I have a question. I frequently ask this of those who are on the show that teach creative writing, because I just find it difficult. Math is easy. You look at it, it's mechanical. Does it work or does it not? Now, grammar and punctuation are easy for the most part. They do change. The rules change, as you know. But for the most part, that's easy to grade on. But I'd imagine the process is harder to grade on creativity and storytelling. Is it a struggle if somebody writes well on a subject, but you care nothing about the subject or even dislike the subject?
I did not teach a lot of creative writing at the community college because I found that students either had a lot of talent but no perseverance, or were working really hard but just had no talent or creativity. And so that dichotomy was upsetting to me. I think that, again, going back to what my students have said about my fair grading, I think that as long as you are clear about what it is that you expect. So, for example, if it's, you know, somebody's writing a story, I might have part of the rubric for the grade be about the introduction to the story. Does the introduction grab the reader? And I think that's something that you can very clearly identify to a student. I just was reading something and the first two pages of this novel were all description.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, by the time I've gotten to the end of page two, we finally get a character, a man sticking his head around a wall and then taking it back. To me, it's easy to grade that and say, why do you read? We read because we want to see character and we want to see things happen. And so I might give you a lower grade on the introduction part of your story because you just haven't grabbed my attention. Once you break down the mechanics of storytelling, I think then you can grade people more effectively. I have to say, once I started using rubrics, so a rubric is basically a set of criteria. You know, you get a certain percentage of your grade based on the mechanics, a certain grade based on the introduction of your essay, etc. Once I started doing that, I never had a student question a grade because they're able to see, oh, this percentage of my grade is based on the introduction. This part is based on description. You know, this part is based on character, etc. So one of the funniest things, I have a freelance editor that I use now for my books, and he always writes a summary of the book. And in one book, he wrote character name, blah, 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 character, blah, blah, blah. And then like, oh, he finally incorporated the character's name 30 pages into the book in his description, because I had never bothered to give the character's name. First person story, you know, nobody ever called him Chemo. And so he, as a reader, didn't know what the character's name was. And he, you know, used that summary to, without telling me, to show me.
Interesting. I've read stories where I had no idea what the character's name was.
And I think that's fine if you're not supposed to. But if you are supposed to know, then you should tell people right away. And again, it's part of connecting with the character. If you know the character's name, if you know a little bit about how he or she looks, then you can connect to them in a way that is harder if you don't know that information.
Right. And regarding your comment about the long descriptions, I think people that have a certain skill have a hard time letting that go. What I mean by that is I was in a writer's group, and there was this woman in the group. She was an amazing writer. But she described everything in excruciating detail. So she described an apple. You could taste it. You could see it. But everything in the story was that way. So they were boring as hell. And I tried to explain to her several times, you know, sometimes just say they reached over and grabbed an apple. You don't have to. We can picture an apple.
Right.
It doesn't always have to be luscious or green or red. And she never could get that. She could, yeah. You know, and I can't deny that she was a beautiful writer in that sense. But when it comes to structure, I guess is the best way I could describe it. It wasn't working.
Well, and I had a similar experience with a woman who I was in graduate school with, who was wonderful at describing emotion. You could really feel what the character felt, but the people never did anything. And so eventually all of that emotion, they're riding, you know, it was like a child riding in the car with her family, and everything was so, you really understood how she felt at that moment. But until they got somewhere and did something, you just didn't care.
That is very true. One thing I want to ask you, because you've pretty much always written in genre fiction, as far as I know. Maybe you've done a little outside of that. This came up just last week. I asked a question in the KDP forum. And for those that don't know, KDP is the name for Amazon's publishing division for self-publishers. And I had a technical question, and I asked it in the forum. One guy responded. He answered the question, but then he couldn't help himself from adding that this may not be true if you write genre or what I call garbage fiction. And I started to respond, and I just said, let it go.
Yeah.
What would you, if you had to say something to that guy, what would it be?
You may call it garbage, but an awful lot of authors who write it call it six-figure incomes.
Thank you. Yeah, that was rather pretentious.
Yeah.
You do all your writing in coffee houses. Is it Starbucks?
I used to, and then we had the pandemic, and I had to become my own barista.
Why is it? Was there something in coffee houses that helps your writing?
I think a lot of writing is putting your butt in the chair and putting yourself in the position to write. And so I really trained myself that when I got to Starbucks, I had only an hour, let's say, before, because I was usually on my way to work.
Uh-huh.
So I would leave the house, drive to Starbucks, get my coffee, sit down and write for an hour, and then go on to school. So I trained myself that this is my writing time. Mm-hmm. And so being in this particular place and this time is where I write. And, you know, yes, I would certainly able to, if I was pursued by the muse, be able to write at home, at the kitchen table, in my office, or, you know, wherever. But just getting, and it's just, it can be any place. It can be a coffee house. It can be a corner of the living room. But if you set that as your writing place, then you know that you are there to do the work. Right now, my writing place is my kitchen table because it's convenient to the coffee maker. We have a nice courtyard to look at. And so, again, that's become my place.
Yeah, you sound a lot like me. I need my place. I also coffee house or library cubicle writer during the pandemic. I had a little table out on the front porch where no one could bother me. It puts you in that right frame of mind, totally. To remind everyone, this is Neil Plaxey. Why I've waited 2.5 years to have him back, I don't know. We talked about it earlier, but I'm glad you did come back. His latest book is Being John Church. It is available for pre-order right now, and you'll get it in about a week, I think it is.
Yep, September 1st.
Go get it.
And just as a side note, the most recent book in the Mahu series is Unruly Son, which is an exploration of family, or ohana, as the Hawaiians call it, and that came out this summer.
Well, we'll make sure we get that in there too. Thank you again for being on.
It's been a pleasure. It's always great to talk to you. And I'm sorry if I can't be as flirtatious as Tony Bedalka.
Yeah, someday if Tony and I meet, our husbands may have to turn their heads. I don't know.
I'm going to see Tony at BoucherCon, the big mystery convention in Minneapolis next month. So,
oh, I'll have to send you a picture. You can take him for me.
Yes.
And if anybody wants to know what we're talking about, go listen to my episode with Tony.
Yes. It's a great one.
It was a great one. Thanks for making me laugh.
All right. Thank you, Brad.